This is Cory Doctorow one more time. I know I said I wasn't going to put out another podcast this week while I'm at Burning Man, but I wanted to record this one too and sneak it out as a little special surprise. It's an essay I wrote for a special issue of the Duke Law and Technology Review, edited by James Boyle, called The Past and Future of the Internet, a symposium for John Perry Barlow. Barlow was one of my mentors and good friends, and he died last year. He was one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, among many other accomplishments. You may also know him as the junior lyricist for the Grateful Dead. Anyway, I wrote an essay for this called Barlow's Legacy, and I just wanted to sneak it into the podcast before I left for the playa, because I'll be thinking of Barlow while I'm there. Barlow's Legacy by Cory Doctorow. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. And now we are come to the great tech lash, long overdue and desperately needed. With the tech lash comes the political contest to assemble the narrative of what just happened and how we got here. Because who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. Barlow is a key figure in that narrative, and so defining his legacy is key to the project of seizing the future. As we contest over that legacy, I will set out here my view on it. It is an insider's view. I met Barlow first through his writing, and then as a teenager on the Well, and then at a dinner in London with EFF attorney Cindy Cohen, now executive director of EFF. And then I worked with him on and off for more than a decade through my work with EFF. He lectured to my students at USC and wrote the introduction to one of my essay collections and hung out with me at Burning Man. And we spoke on so many bills together, and I wrote him into one of my novels as a character, an act that he blessed. I emceed events where he spoke and sat with him in his hospital room as he lay dying. I make no claim to being Barlow's best or closest friend, but I count myself mightily privileged to have been a friend, a colleague, and a protege of his. There is a story today about cyber utopians told as part of the tech lash. Once there were people who believed that the internet would automatically be a force for good. They told us all to connect to one another and fended off anyone who sought to rein in the power of the technology industry, naively ushering in an era of mass surveillance, monopolism, manipulation, even genocide. These people might have been well-intentioned, but they were smart enough that they should have known better, and if they hadn't been so unforgivably naive and possibly secretly in the pay of future monopolists, we might not be in such dire shape today. In support of this contention, they cite aphorisms like "the net interprets censorship as damage and routes around it," coined by Barlow's EFF co-founder and erstwhile roommate John Gilmore, who rivals Barlow for the title of Internet Zealot. Gilmore had a hand in the invention of the free software movement, the legalization of civilian access to cryptography, the ISP industry, commercial open source, software-defined radio, marijuana legalization, and 100 other projects, large and small. But context is everything. The net interprets censorship as damage and routes around it was a prescription as much as an observation. It was uttered in the context of a nascent internet, whose technical caretakers disagreed on many ethical and technological points, but were united in a sense of civic duty to keep the technology open and universal and, quote, free as in freedom. Gilmore didn't mean, "Stand down, everyone! We've built a censor-proof internet that will automatically maintain its integrity." He meant, "To you, my comrades in arms, who toil endlessly to make our bulky, wonderful invention run, I say, the same measures that we take to re-knit our network, when a technical failure tears holes in its fabric, can be repurposed to resist censorship, to route around the nodes that have fallen under a censor's thrall. Our shared civic mission, heretofore dedicated primarily to the technical task of preserving a forum for discourse, can and should be expanded to the political task of preserving that forum. And what's more, the tactics that we have mastered so thoroughly for the former will serve us in the latter." Critics of political slogans take note. The fact that a complex idea is reduced to a pithy bumper sticker is not necessarily reductive. It can be a necessary and extremely valuable convenience. A URL is not a web page, and even the best URL rarely substitutes for the page it refers to. But requiring us to forego pointers and deal only in things to refer to web pages solely by their complete texts, rather than the brief summaries that unambiguously point to them, would be a hard discourse. When Barlow advocated for a free internet, free in all the usefully overlapping and ambiguous senses of that word, he wasn't doing so because he lacked an appreciation of the risks of a monopolized internet, or an internet that was under the thumb of a repressive state. Rather, he did so precisely because he feared that a globe-spanning network of ubiquitous, sensor-studded actuating devices that were designed and governed without some kind of ethical commitment, without the pioneering spirit of the early internet and its yeoman smallholders who defended it from those who sought to dominate or pervert it, that we would arrive at a dystopian future where the entertainment industry's Huxleyism was the means for realizing that we would arrive at a dystopian future where the entertainment industry's Huxleyism was the means for realizing the nightmares of Orwell. You don't found an organization like the Electronic Frontier Foundation because you are sanguine about the future of the internet. You do so because your hope for an amazing open future is haunted by the terror of a network suborned for the purposes of spying and control. If there is hope, it lies in the pearls. The techlash began within tech, naturally. Notwithstanding the genuine privilege blindness of techies who often live in a bubble of wealth, technological competence, and agency, no one was better situated to spot the problems with tech, market concentration, the reckless collection and warehousing of sensitive personal information, deceptive and manipulative business practices, the misuse of tech by repressive states, bullies, stalkers, and would-be ethnic cleansers, than people who understood precisely how the technology worked and knew the people responsible for the key decisions and understood their frailty and their capacity for self-deception. These early coal mine canaries were atomized and isolated. At EFF, we heard from some of them, whistleblowers who came in with printouts and wild tales. Think of Mark Klein, who wandered through the front door of the old Shotwell Street office in San Francisco's Mission District with a sheaf of documents and a hard-to-believe tale about his years at AT&T building a secret room for the NSA to use while illegally wiretapping the whole internet. Klein wasn't a crank. He was a hero, and the litigation spawned by his act of bravery is still underway more than a decade later. Tech is a great force multiplier. The canny user of technology can protect their will over millions or even billions of devices, and potentially over the people who use those devices too. That kind of power is terrifying, especially in the hands of unaccountable, frail, and fallible elites. The project of teaching STEM to everyone did not begin as an attempt to maximize the national GDP by raising a generation of startup founders. It was a prescient attempt at self-defense, a mission to pluralize the power of tech. Tech is not a force unto itself. Technology's imperatives are the imperatives of the people who design, control, and use technology. Information doesn't want to be free, but people do. Barlow loved people. When Skype was invented, he kept it turned on at all hours and allowed anyone in the world to initiate a session with him. Some were colleagues, some were admirers, and a good fraction were randos who were just exploring this new video conferencing system. Barlow doted on those randos and rhapsodized about the joys of helping a stranger halfway across the world practice their conversational English. The last time I spoke with Barlow, as he lay in a hospital bed in San Francisco, he told me that if he ever got out, he wanted to go and drive a car for Lyft and just meet new people all day long and talk to them about what they wanted and what he wanted and make human connections. Barlow was not naive about the ways in which humans could be terrible to each other and themselves. His posthumously published memoir, finished just weeks after he died, is simultaneously full of celebrations of the people who crossed his path and score settling that verges on unseemly or even petty. It's just that Barlow thought that the answer to human frailty was more humans. The answer to an empathy gap was spending time with the people for whom you lacked empathy. That while these things did not guarantee the development of an ethical stance, their absence guaranteed a kind of rootless, free-floating sociopathy. Doctrinal free market thinkers have excused much sociopathy with the self-evident aphorism that incentives matter. As with the net interpret censorship, etc., etc., this saying references much subtext, notably the idea that kindness creates dependency and helplessness. It is a doctrine of cruelty dressed up as pragmatism, but incentives do matter. Designing a system that can only be navigated by being a selfish bastard creates selfish bastardry, and the cognitive dissonance of everyday cruelties generates a kind of protective scar tissue in the form of a reflex of judgment, dismissal, and cruelty. And contrariwise, designing a system where we celebrate civic duty, kindness, empathy, and the giving of gifts without the expectation of reward produces an environment where the angels of your better nature can shout down the cruel lizard brain impulses that mutter just below the threshold of perception. Freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. Generations of elevation of selfishness to virtue has produced a public discourse where espousing a belief in human goodness marks you out as a patsy at best and a dangerous idiot at worst. There is a statistical illiteracy to this proposition. After all, if 99.9% of the world is composed of bastards, how unlikely is it that you and everyone you know are just unremarkable flawed vessels whose nature fluctuates between reaction and reason? But the idea that humans are mostly okay and made worse or better by the stories they tell about their own nature has been in disrepute since the Reagan years. And without the freedom to admit this otherwise obvious truth, we've had to compose all kinds of other excuses for our world. Take concentration of tech into big tech. The theorists who insisted that unfettered markets and doctrinal selfishness would produce competitive and vibrant markets find themselves scrambling to explain the conversion of the internet from a crazy bazaar into 5 big services filled with screenshots from the other 4. They field all manner of unconvincing explanations for this phenomenon, like first mover advantage or network effects, because they can't say that dismantling antitrust enforcement gave rise to a new wave of trusts on a scale not seen since the robber barons. But if first movers and network effects predicted success, we'd all be searching the internet by logging into AltaVista from our craze. The utterly plausible explanation for big tech, that we stopped enforcing the rules that punished underhanded growth tactics like mergers to monopoly, is resisted with the fervor of an anti-vaxxer explaining away their kids' measles. It's not because I didn't get her vaccinated, it's because of environmental toxins. Bigness multiplies all the risks of tech. Putting everyone's social lives on Facebook creates a one-stop shop for mass-scale manipulation. Putting everyone's mobile data in one of 2 silos creates an irresistible target for state surveillance. Putting everyone's attention at the mercy of 4 or 5 gatekeepers turns their normal human foibles and cherished illusions into facts of life that everyone in the world must navigate. Think of this in analogy to climate change. Your racist Facebook uncle's climate denial around the Thanksgiving table may ruin your digestion, but it won't cook the planet. But change your uncle's name to Coke, give him a multi-billion-dollar war chest, give it a generation, and before you know it, we'll be drinking our urine and digging through rubble looking for canned goods. In the same way your idiotic college roommate's social theory that everyone should just be honest all the time might make you want to change the locks on your dorm room. But make that kid's name Zuckerberg, put him in charge of the social lives of 2 billion people, and his bizarre belief that, quote, having 2 identities for yourself is an example of a lack of integrity, becomes an existential threat to human thriving. Implicit in the belief in bigness is a belief in a special kind of person, an Ayn Randian titan whose innate superiority is so fabulous that any attempt to rein it in will redound to the detriment of us all. Markets act as a kind of sorting hat, finding those natural rulers and elevating them to positions of power, and the scurrying little people's misguided attempts to dethrone them must be resisted, for their own sakes. But no one is smart enough and competent enough to be the dictator of 2 billion people's social lives. It's not merely that Mark Zuckerberg is wrong about how people get along, it's that no one is right enough to wield that power. Generations of insistence that some of us are born to rule, and revelations that the people who rise to power in that environment are at best fallible and at worst deplorable, have created a kind of massive dissonance, a great collective yearning for a one true king to lead us out of our dark times. There's a narrative about Cambridge Analytica and the 2016 election of a boorish white supremacist grifter to the U.S. presidency. It goes like this. Cambridge Analytica lied about everything except their sales literature, where they truthfully revealed that they had discovered a way to turn Facebook into a mind control ray that would make decent people into racists. But there's another, more plausible version of that narrative. It goes like this. Facebook spied on everyone and found all the racists whose imperfections have a variety of causes, but prominent among them is the belief that some people are better than others and markets tell you who is and isn't good. Having found the racists, Cambridge Analytica quietly convinced them that voting for Donald Trump would advance their cause. This version of events suggests several countermeasures. Make Facebook stop spying on people. Help people see that the winners and losers in the marketplace are better predicted by cruelty and indifference to their neighbors than by virtue. Ease the anxiety that everyone who doesn't win big in the 21st century lottery will lose terribly. That is, fix the incentives. Find the better natures of people. Help people understand and master their technology. Reverse the forces that permit a few people to rise to dominate the rest of us. That is, treat the internet with the gravitas that it is due, as a system that can be a force for great human flourishing, but only if we ensure that it isn't used to snuff out human dignity and agency. Barlow made his reputation for insisting long before it would be obvious to most people that getting the internet's future right would be a necessary precondition for getting humanity's future right. By insisting that the toy network used for telling jokes and arguing about Star Trek would grow up to be a pluripotent network that allowed anyone anywhere to talk to anyone else anywhere using any program or protocol they chose. By insisting that the internet be regulated with regard to all the ways that would come to touch our lives in the future, and not merely as a better radio station, or a very convenient video on demand service, or a jihadi recruiting tool, or the greatest pornography distribution system in human history. When a problem is a long way off, activists' primary activity for many years is simply to convince people that there is a problem, that someday your cigarettes will give you cancer, that someday climate change will threaten billions of lives, that someday the text messaging system called, quote, the internet will grow to be our species-wide, civilization-spanning nervous system. But if the activist is right, then eventually convincing people that there is a problem takes care of itself. Your doctor finds a tumor. California burns. Burmese mobs visit genocide upon the Rohingya. I call that moment peak indifference. It's the moment when the problem's unchecked progress creates its own momentum, and every day of their own accord, people recognize that the problem is there. After peak indifference, the activist's job changes. Now they must convince people not to give in to nihilism. Because by the time a problem like cancer or climate or concentration is so manifest that we can't deny it, it can seem like it's too late to do anything about it. After peak indifference, the activist's job changes to convincing people to have hope. Barlow never gave up hope. He was unabashedly, unashamedly, publicly, and vocally hopeful. That hope plays into the narrative of techno-utopian naivete. But Barlow wasn't naive. He knew how much trouble we were in, and he also knew how wonderful things could be if we could only dig ourselves out of that trouble. The tech lash isn't a repudiation of Barlow's hopefulness. It is his vindication. Barlow's legacy, then, isn't a foolish belief that history would steer clear of dystopia of its own accord. Rather, his legacy is the noble belief that we, together, pluralistically, and through collective reasoning and collective action, could navigate the dangerous waters we find ourselves in, patch the holes the rocks knocked in our ship, and find our way to a better land. All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.